sympathy. I don't mind, cause you mean that much to me. Ain't too proud of bed, and you know it. Please don't leave me, girl. Ain't too proud of bed, baby, baby. Please don't leave me, girl.
I'm Mark Steiner, back here with my monthly co-host, Leah Gilmore.
Yes, I'm Leah Gilmore, and I ain't too proud to bed.
Hello, Ann. Why are we playing that? Because, sadly, Richard Street, one of the Great Temptations, passed away on this day, so we are honoring them with that. We could just play the Temps and be done with it.
I know that's right. An hour of the Temptations and these amazing folks we have with us.
I know what I'm playing when I get in my car. Okay, so
we honor him.
Leah Gilmore is in the house, of course, Center for Emerging Media's cultural editor and senior fellow for social justice at the Robert W. Deutsch Foundation, award-winning musician, singer, gone for days, but she's just been named one of 2014's top 100 women by the Daily Record.
That's pretty amazing.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. I'm still trying to figure out how that happened, but that's really wonderful. Me and the CEOs and the judges and Leah Gilmore.
That's not like that. And we are joined here in studio by Dina Hagag. And
hello.
I'm dying to meet you. I'm glad you're in the studio.
I am so happy to meet her.
She's our new director of the Contemporary, not the Contemporary Museum, the Contemporary.
Yes, sir.
Formerly curator in residence at the Gallery
CA.
CA in Baltimore City Arts Building, on the board of Whoop-De-Doo, Station North 2 Library, and is dean of the Baltimore Chapter of Awesome Foundation, named 10 People to Watch Under 30 by the Baltimore Sun in 2013.
Also, I have no idea how I got on that list.
Okay.
Again.
I think I do. And under 30.
Under 30.
That's not the list I'm on. Okay.
Could I be on that list?
No. No.
I just saw you two dancing earlier to the Temptations, and you could be under 30.
Oh,
I saw your
definitely.
Moves.
All right.
I saw it.
Oh, girl, we have moves.
I saw.
We also have age. I can be under the 50. Can they do 50 under 50?
We could do it.
Okay. You can't do that either.
So
let's talk about Dina. She's so amazing.
So, welcome. I'm glad you're here.
Thank you for having me.
So the Contemporary has been on this program over the years in different, it's all this different kind of
manifests.
Yes. And so I'm curious, you've come in now as the director of the Contemporary. So talk for just a second quickly about what happened and why this new direction is taking place and what this new direction is you're leading the Contemporary.
Sure.
Because you had a space once, and the space is gone.
Yep.
No more space.
Yeah. So the Contemporary, around the turn of the millennium, moved into a building next door to the Walters on Center Street and existed there very fruitfully for 10 years. And the lease was up, and they were sort of shopping, the Board of Trustees at that time and staff. And I believe at some point between initially shopping for a building and my joining them, someone had decided that was not the best course of action, which I personally completely agree with. I think Baltimore is very different now than it was in 2000, and it is time for that museum to return to the streets a little bit. And also it was just, not just from a programming standpoint, but financially I think it was wise. I think the art world is waiting with breath that is bated for the economy to change, and if it doesn't, I mean, just flow with the times. And to be truly contemporary, I think we needed to do the best that we could with the resources that we had. So since deciding not to get a building, we've been able to quite literally allocate all of our resources for programming, for staff, and do the most robust kind of art making that we could have envisioned.
And when you say return to the streets,
yes,
what do you mean?
So we're sort of working a little. So in the first 10 years, when George Sissel had founded the Contemporary, it operated outside of a building. And it did art projects in other people's buildings, like the
we
BMA
love
and
you,
the
George.
Walters. Yeah, George. Yes. Hi, George. but also it did things in parking garages, various festivals. It worked with artists in different capacities. And I think we're looking back to that model, so trying to team an artist, an audience, and a site. And that site can be a lot of different things. It doesn't have to be a physical place. We have a wonderful team on staff. We have a program manager, Ginevra Shea, and our business manager, Lu Zhang, and we make dream lists, artists we're interested in working with, sites in Baltimore we think are important,
give us the example of what you're talking about.
So, like, I am obsessed. It's like my personal thing. I love historic cemeteries, and I think Baltimore
has.
I know. They're like
crazy. Every city I go to, I go to the cemetery.
Cemeteries are, and they're really complex things. Right. Like, the graves are owned by families, the pathways are owned by the public, but the cemetery itself is owned usually by a city or state.
I've never thought that deeply, but
that's true. Bizarre intersections, yeah. Or, you know, Penn Station is something I think about. In my, personally, I think about a lot. I know our staff, we we talk a lot about like historic sites. Like we were really interested in like the Peel Museum, for example, as one site that we talk about sometimes. Or even looking at projects that aren't on a site and things artists could send or make or utilizing the internet or digital media. We also talk about audiences a lot. I worked in Sandtown Winchester for a period of time, and I really love that neighborhood, and I think a lot about wanting to do something there. Brooklyn Curtis Bay, you know, all the arts districts and sort of the all the great work they're doing and partnering with them. So it's interesting. So we have three or four projects in the works, and some were sort of seeded by a site. Others were an artist, and then there's always a lot of consideration for the audience we're trying to.
So that's separate than what you did, like with Coco Fusco when you brought her to town as a speaker series. These are two separate projects.
So the projects are sort of one or two a year, maybe three, really allocating our resources, taking the time needed to make these robust things
happen, these
experiential things happen. The speaker series is something we were interested in doing because before we reopened Nomadically, we surveyed dozens and dozens of people in town, and everybody said, we want to learn more about what's happening globally. And so we kind of put our brains together and thought, we should do a speaker series, and we should make sure that it's always curated very, very diversely. This first year, we partnered with 13 independently run galleries, most of which are self-organized by artists. And we just asked them, who's a dream artist you'd want us to bring to Baltimore? And we sort of got their lists, and we played a matchmaking game and looked at our finances and invited one artist on behalf of this gallery's, on behalf of the galleries that submitted the lists. And it's wonderful. I mean, it's such a broad spectrum of artists coming. It's not my taste. It's not my staff's taste. It's a really great reflection of what's happening internationally in contemporary art. And each of those artists does studio visits with classrooms or artists living here in Baltimore. So again, trying to connect, what are people doing out of the city? How do we connect it to what's happening here? Sort of make some magic happen if we can.
So what are some of the your programs that you're doing now? You mentioned that you do two a year and focus on that. Mm-hmm. What's one of them?
We can't release too much yet because
I
don't have anything
to
sign yet.
I know. I was going to say, I said, if I get something out of this, this would be great.
I know. And I can't yet. But I will say that we're looking pretty generously at doing something this fall.
Okay.
So, and the announcements will hopefully come before the summer, but we need a few last T's crossed.
Well, that's a nice teaser.
Before I can do that.
All right. Tease on.
Tease on. That's right. I just think that the fact that the contemporary is alive and growing and and full of vitality and has such energy behind a leader as yourself, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think you're also seem to be interested in serving or partnering with underserved communities.
Yeah.
What are some of the things you've done? Like you mentioned Sandtown Winchester, or what are some of the dream projects you'd want to do?
Oh God. Sandtown Winchester, I worked really briefly with the Jubilee Arts Center there.
Oh, Jubilee.
Through MICA and sort of a CDP program. I guess it's just, so it's a few different things. First of all, logistically speaking, it's not easy, but it's entirely possible to pull off these like massive art projects in places if the community just wants it there. And I think I'm really curious to see what community reception is to work. I also want to define, I want to think very broadly about community arts, public arts, socially engaged practices, and I don't want to corner any one of them or prescribe in advance what I think any of them mean. And I think that's one of the beauties of the contemporary right now is that it's really just looking at the city, and that involves the people that live here, the institutions that exist here, the politicians that make these things possible, and making projects for very so. For example, we say community a lot, and we've been trying in our office to use like neighborhood, you know, and it's not looking at like entire communities, but like where are we?
Well, we're such a neighborhood-based city.
Exactly. And how do we tie in these sort of neighborhoods into our mission and what we're doing? And also in advance, knowing when to put the brakes on something. So, you know, saying this, we're forcing this. This isn't going to happen here. And sort of retreating a little bit and having the ethics, I guess, to do that. And I think that that can get lost a little bit with some of the advancements of community art. So it's kind of interesting because I'm talking about it, but we haven't gotten to do anything
because
yet.
Because part of this is all being formulated because you're just beginning.
Yeah.
So
just you're just beginning. Yeah. This new contemporary is just beginning. I mean, what I've heard, I was really upset we didn't get a chance to have Coco Fusco on the show when she was
here.
Coming to town.
She's
and
wonderful.
Here. But you're having these things at the Baltimore School for the Arts.
Yes.
These lecture series.
Co-host,
speaker series. And you talked about people like Coco Fusco, who is this great artist coming down from New York, who is
amazing.
Deeply involved in community stuff.
Yes.
And her artwork.
Yes.
And her politics. Mm-hmm. They're all out there.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
Is that kind of, is that the spirit of these series you're trying to do, speakers, or is it something even broader than that?
I think it's a little broader than that. I will say that I loved, so Rod Malin, who is the director of Guest Spot Gallery, is the person that recommended Coco. And I think that for me was really interesting, was to see where his temperature was on what was happening and who he wanted to bring here, and watching them interact all day and see. I mean, it was just so wonderful. But artists like that are artists like I love to watch. I mean, watching Coco, sorry about that, talk about what she does is like brilliant. You know, she's possibly one of the smartest people I've ever heard speak. But yeah, these artists that are not afraid to engage politics are definitely invited to play at the Contemporary. We're eager.
We like
to work
that.
With them. Yeah, I can imagine you would like that.
I'm just wondering, where did this come from for you? I mean, were you always an artist? Are you an artist?
No.
You know. Mm-mm. So where does this come from?
Not at all.
No, I barely can color inside the lines. I am not an artist at all.
But that's inspirational to many people who love the arts and want to be a part of the arts but can't do it.
Yeah. Like I know, I guess in an abstracted sense that I want to spend my life around the arts, but I know that I cannot do them at all in any way.
So what has been your sojourn to all this then?
Right. I don't know. I think I'm just really good at email. Like, can email be like my art form?
Because you clearly have kind of moved in this artistic world in this direction.
Yeah.
So what is that sojourn for you? What is it for you?
Where'd you come from?
Yeah, right.
Okay. So I started college looking at the sciences, thinking I wanted to be a doctor and sort of really doing that. And I don't know at what point – there's a few different things, but at some point in time I realized that – artists existed, and I guess I hadn't really thought about that ever before. And I was in college, so it's pretty late in the game. It wasn't something that came to me in high school or before then. So I started just curating, so to speak, but I didn't really fundamentally understand what that was. And I mean, it's pretty classic. I had a group of professors. I took an art history class, and I actually almost failed my first one. So the teacher to pass me told me I had to take Art History 102. And I think that was it. Like, I think she noticed that I was pretty smart in class, but I was so lazy, you know? And she was like, you have to take the rest of my classes or I'm going to fail you. And I was like, damn it. Okay. and it kind of stuck. And I'm still in contact with that professor, and I appreciate her tremendously.
There's always that one.
Yeah, man.
It is.
And they can spot from
so
a mile away.
You are an artist, but your art is curating.
Yes. Yeah.
And curating, that is curating as an art.
Yeah.
I mean, when I've gone to museums now, and these last couple of exhibits, we saw the one at Reginald F. Lewis, the Jerkoff exhibit in D.C., the other exhibits that the Walters I've seen done. I mean, when you are a curator, you have to be totally consumed by the art, the artists, the era, the history.
Right.
I mean,
exactly.
It's a lot.
The sense, but it's artistic vision. Where you place things, how they look, what people are going to see, what they're going to feel as they
because
walk through.
Because that's how the story gets told. Yeah.
That is. You're curating art.
Yeah. No, totally. And I think it's beautiful to do it at a museum like ours because it's not totally object-based.
Yeah,
so it sort of feels
great.
Like curating a process with another team of people. It sort of feels like a refereeing or coaching or something, you know, like getting somebody to a project and learning tremendously from them because they're the ones in the game. You know, like they're the ones sort of making the project happen, these artists.
Who have been your mentors? I'm sorry to interrupt you. But who have been your mentors here?
Oh, there's a lot of people. So George Sissel, absolutely.
Yes.
I mean, I came to
the
my
king of curatorial
the,
art.
Yeah, he founded the museum.
Yes,
it's like inheriting daddy's business, you know, like George. So definitely George Sissel. There's a lot of people. I joined the Contemporary's efforts because of Karen Stoltz, who's the community, who's the director of community engagement at MICA. And I know Kalima will be on the show later. And, you know, I worked with Karen a lot through college and or grad school, rather. So I learned a lot from sort of the work that she was doing. My mentors have oddly changed kind of since taking this because I've had to learn a skill set I didn't have, sort of nonprofit business, keeping something sustainable. Terry Squires is our board chair, and I'm always floored at how she can be business-minded but also think creatively and know how to sort of mix the two pretty eloquently. And then there's organizations I look to, and I studied extensively before taking on the Contemporary. Land in California is, I think they're doing amazing work in the public realm, and one of their directors on our curatorial advisory council now. I begged and begged and begged. Tom Finkelpearl, who's also on our council. It's dawning on me that these are all my mentors, and I just begged them to join the Contemporary. Now that I'm talking about it, I'm like, oh, this makes sense.
Sounds like my life.
Yeah. Dang.
So we're just beginning. I mean, this is the beginning of a new adventure for Baltimore.
Right.
I mean, the direction the Contemporary is going to take, taking art and artists into our communities and seeing the reaction back and forth,
yeah,
whatever those specific projects will be that you'll tell us about
mm-hmm.
in a couple of months, or yes. your speaker series that you're doing. And what's coming up next in the speaker series?
Brendan Fowler. That's Wednesday, March 5th.
Who is?
He is a visual artist. He is based in California, but also works extensively internationally, and he's being invited here by Nudishank.
At what time is it?
That is at, the reception starts at 6. His lecture mm-hmm. will be at 7, and it is at the Baltimore School for the Arts. We're super excited. I am personally very, very excited about Brendan coming. I've been wanting to hear him speak about his work for a long time, so I'm pretty psyched about it.
Well, you may see us there.
And it's
yeah,
and it's been – I've heard from you. I have not, did not go to the Fusco piece, which I wish I had. I really sorry I missed that. But
yeah.
I understand that people are just flocking to this speaker series that has mm-hmm. been slammed.
Yeah. I know.
Right?
We like pinch ourselves. We're like, is this happening?
No, because you're doing the
you
good
know?
Stuff.
Yeah.
This is good.
That's why you're doing the – and see, the thing is, you see, you're filling a need in Baltimore
yeah.
that people want it.
Yeah.
And they didn't even know they wanted it.
Yeah, it is. It's one of the most.
You know?
Yeah,
it's true.
There you go.
It
right,
is.
right.
Yeah. And Baltimore's a really intellectually like rigorous city. Like people want.
Yes.
Yeah, it's right. wonderful.
So, how do people find out about this? Give them folks like you know.
Sure. You can go to our website, contemporary.org. There's a page on their speaker series that highlights everything. We also have an Eventbrite page, the Contemporary Museum. You can look for stuff there. We also have Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Probably something new that's just been invented that I don't even know about yet. And all of our information is there as well.
Well, Dina Hagag, finally great to meet you at last.
Thank you.
Wonderful
you too.
To meet
both
good to have you
thank
here.
You. Thank you very much.
It's been great.
So
thank
proud of you.
Oh,
yeah.
So proud of you, 100 top ladies.
Yeah, under 30 yeah. girl.
Under 50 woman. Yeah. That's awesome. Thank you
so
very much.
I'm sure we'll be meeting.
Yeah,
quite
come
often.
To Brendan Fowler. I'll look
yes.
for you now.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So we'll have you back. We're looking forward to having you back as part maybe of our we have these constant discussions around arts and the future of Baltimore. So
right.
look forward to having you be part of those.
It's great. I look forward to it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We're taking this break now. Lee and I will be right back.
Yes.
Have our roundtable of artists looking at art and social justice in Baltimore coming up.
There you go.
And we are going out right now with a little Frankie Lyman since he died on this day in our day in history. And he's the guy who invented that move, you know, wipe off your shoulders move in music.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a little before.
Can you do that again? That's
yeah.
great. Mark Steiner is wiping off his shoulders.
Right.
Little Frank Lyman yeah. time. So,
we need video in here.
Well, that's coming.
Not with me.
Why not, baby?
We're just right there.
So Frankie Lyman, we're going to go out with a bit of Frankie Lyman. And I'm not a juvenile delinquent. I love that piece. I'm not a juvenile delinquent, the young Frankie Lyman.
That's the title?
I'm not a juvenile delinquent. I was a juvenile delinquent. But we'll be right back. Don't go away.
That's another story.
Back to my childhood, Frankie Lyman.
That's all about you, honey. I know about your childhood. Remember, I narrated that thing on you.
That's right, you did. You did.
That's
right.
A lesson
from Frankie Lyman. Mm. Stevie Wonder was one who we all remember as a young singer, but Frankie Lyman was, he was a joint back in the day.
Well, he was definitely important.
So, Leah.
So, Mark.
We have
here we are.
Well, before we start, let me just say this. I got to say this because this is really important for our program as well. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeCube Baltimore's Credit Union, offering a full range of financial services. MeCube Baltimore's Credit Union is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeCube invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you, and money comes back in the end. More information, www.mecu.com, or you can go to steinershow.org and click on MeCube Baltimore Credit Union's banner.
There you go.
There we go.
Well
They're
said.
A good group. So, I don't know if I can say that on public radio, but I did. Anyhow.
Well, it's over. You did it.
I did it, baby. So we're here with Kalima Young, director of the Baltimore Art and Justice Project, a project of the Office of Community Engagement at Michael and Maryland Institute College of Art. And
hello.
We'll say again that Kalima was one of the first guests on the Mark Steiner Show back in 1993. Monday is our 21st anniversary.
Oh, my goodness. That's amazing.
Wow. Kalima was class of 93. We followed the class of 93.
And Kalima's now in a PhD program.
Yeah.
And has just lost 130 pounds.
Why are you telling all my stuff like that? Yeah.
Because
you
this is my girl.
This is
an amazing panel of people I know.
I know. You look like you did 21 years ago, baby.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
David Mitchell's in the house, program director of the Urban Arts Leadership Program at the Greater Baltimore Cultural Alliance. Good to see you, David.
Good to
just
see
had
you
a new
well.
Baby.
Yeah. Theater maven. Nether's in the house. Well, I've also known since he was very young, which is pretty scary, street artist, one of the artists who participated in the Baltimore Slumlord Watch Wall Hunters Project, which brought attention to vacant properties and the neglectful property owners. And another good to have you in the house as well, man.
Thanks for having me again.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner. Tweet us at Mark Steiner.
You can tweet us.
Tweet us. Tweet us well. Just don't tweet
just
us bad.
Just don't tweet us bad. Also, yeah. Please, because those are really bad jokes.
That was bad.
Yeah. But you know what's not bad is this amazing group that we've gathered here together.
So you start us off.
Okay. You know what's so amazing? When I think of first about Nether and I think about when I know his father very well, and when I saw him last, before the first other time, it was like this little tiny boy, and now he's this really tall guy doing the good work out there for art, and Kalima Young and David Mitchell, who I think I talk to at least once a week, each of you. And I can tell you that they are doing amazing things in Baltimore. Kalima, let's start with you. The Baltimore Art Plus Justice Project.
Yes.
This is a significant an unprecedented project here in Baltimore. So tell us, what is it?
Well, this is what we are. So we've built this interactive website that captures artists, designers, nonprofits, and activists who see themselves working at this intersection of art and social justice in Baltimore. So we invite these particular groups of folks to create a profile on our website so that other people can find them and so that they can find each other to collaborate. My general idea, our idea is that if we can bring these different groups together, they will create art and design social justice-based projects that will improve Baltimore City.
Mm.
The website officially launched in June of last year. We have about 200 folks profiled on it so far. It's going through a huge functionality restructuring right now, so a new version of it's going to be premiering next week, actually. Mm. An easier registration process for everyone. We're very excited. We're also moving into a really great place-based strategy where we're going to be focusing on specific neighborhoods and trying to activate those neighborhoods. That means getting all of the artists and nonprofits in those neighborhoods to get profiled on the map and then work with community organizations and things there to identify an issue they may want to work on and then come up with an art and justice-based solution to it.
David, the first time we met, you were running theater.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I still kind of run theater.
You do.
Yeah,
but I mean,
Presently, I work with Arena Players of Baltimore, Maryland, as well as working with the Greater Baltimore Cultural Alliance. So for Arena Players, I serve as an assistant artistic director and help out with programming, and I sit on their board of directors. Yeah.
So we're going to take a brief break and come back. And we'll come back, we're going to leap right into the question of the role that artists play in social change, in change in our community, and in, I might even add, revolutionary change in our community, and how that might fit.
Yes.
I'll talk about what that means in a minute as well. So we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to go out with Hanky Panky by Tommy James and the Shondells. Eddie Gray was born on this day, so Hanky Panky.
A little research going on back there.
My baby does the hanky panky. Yeah, my baby does the hanky panky. Hey, my baby does the hanky panky. My baby does. Waterfalls.
Don't go chasing them. What you know about waterfalls?
TLC, Chili was born on the stage. We're playing the music.
Come on.
Mark
Steiner.
I can't know things.
No,
I got to be Mark stuck in the blues.
So I am stuck in the blues,
right,
and I love it there.
Well, how do you know about this stuff then?
You know, I was born in a log cabin where they told me all about TLC, and they taught me things. I'm a black woman. It's my right.
Okay,
thank
fine.
You. Yeah.
Fine. Just leave me out.
Okay.
So,
yeah, you're not a black woman, so
no,
you are left out. Okay,
I'm not a black woman. You're right. You are right about that.
So. I'm sorry. I do have want to talk to David a little bit.
Okay.
All right. So, then back to Nita.
Yeah, we'll come back to this. I mean, it's the idea. Catherine, I have a broad question.
Yeah, here, sure.
All of you have been involved in the arts on one level or another. Street art. Working with art, people who are involved in social justice and art in the community, you've been involved with theater and young mm-hmm. people, and also trying to create what I thought when you first did it, creating the first really interracial theater company in Baltimore
yeah.
City.
Cause, oh, right on
that's
theater.
Right.
Yeah.
When you did that, because there were very few theaters in town that really mixed.
It was to me, it was unprecedented.
It was.
Yeah.
It was, and you did some great work back then.
Yeah, absolutely.
you did great work, I thought.
Should be very proud of that.
Thank you.
So the question, I'm
and the murals, and the very exciting murals that Nita is putting up that are not just to beautify the neighborhoods, which I do love as well, mm-hmm. but are having a message, involves the communities as well, mm-hmm. unlike so many other things that just go into the community mm-hmm. and say, this is what's going to happen for you. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. That's another story.
It's important.
And, yes. Mm-hmm. And, but taking from that, Leah, from what you just said,
mm-hmm.
What do you all think really is the role of an artist, whatever that art may be, in fighting for change? And people say, well, you shouldn't mix politics and art. Do you know what I'm saying? That art is something for us to kind of...
I don't know who said that.
A lot of people say that now.
Yeah. Well, they are wrong.
So talk about what you think that means. I'm curious what you think it means for you, what it means for the artistic community. What does it mean an artist involved in social change? What the hell does that mean?
I think it's unavoidable, especially in urban environments. You know mm-hmm. that your art is going to be influenced by all that is going on. It just takes on that form. I actually am still wrapping my head around the idea of being an activist, and Kalima helped me to do that once we sat down.
What do you mean by that?
Last year, well, when she was going around interviewing mm-hmm. everybody for her project, you know, she was like, "Yeah, so we you know, you've been brought up as an activist type." I'm like, "What are you talking about? I do theater. That's it. You know, but I do theater that's includes the community, that's
right.
in response oftentimes to an issue mm-hmm. That's going on socially." And maybe you're right. You know, kind of a thing.
Yay.
So
that's advocacy.
Yeah,
that's right.
Neither.
Yeah, I guess how I'd respond to that is I don't think art has the most power in the world, but what it can do is it can catalyze more conversation about different topics and issues. Mm-hmm. And in Baltimore, where there's a lot of topics and issues that are very ignored and define our city's problems, I think it can catalyze, you know, that type of thought that, like, hey, maybe we can do something here. I mean, I can just think through not just only the Wall Hunters Project, but countless other interactions and experiences that you can actually see it. Like, For instance, like I helped the artist Nanook paint a mural on West Baltimore at Mosher in Carrollton. In like 2 days, I mean, like I think it was the day before actually, there was multiple shooting in that neighborhood, and the neighborhood was kind of really hurting at the moment. And we went out there the next day. Since we had been planning to do this mural, we started it, and all of a sudden this guy rounds the block. Sees what we're doing, watches us for a little bit, then goes back to his house and comes back around the block with all these like weed whackers stuff so we can pull the vines off this wall that we're painting.
You didn't know him.
I didn't know him. Just awesome. A random soul who he was hurting. His whole neighborhood was hurting, and he saw us, and he literally he said, you know, like, I saw you guys doing this, and it made me want to do something to help this block as well. And it's just like that. And, like, that's just one example, you know. So, you know, it's just a mural, but it might
– Not just
it's
a mural.
Never
yeah,
just
it's
a mural,
never
right?
just a mural.
Right.
Just a mural. It's
right.
never just
– Or
I mean,
just a song every, or just a play. Or,
everything
you know.
Gets really loaded.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, that's just one example. But, you know, I drive by that block all the time now just because I'm in that area. And that block is still clear. Like, mm-hmm. And it wasn't. Before we showed up.
I don't think we give people enough credit at the respect that art is given by all communities. Mm-hmm. You know, we are so we stereotype communities into believing into these one type of way of being. But I think that when people, to me, the biggest issue about arts and is access. Mm-hmm. That is the social justice issue.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Equitable access mm-hmm. to the arts. Absolutely. And I think all of us in this room volunteer and work with kids when we have the opportunity, because they are not the first thing to go. The first thing to go mm-hmm. are the arts.
Right.
But
mm-hmm.
we know that academic scores go up immensely when kids are exposed to arts. So not only park school children should have the opportunity to play an instrument, to sing a song, to be in a choir, to be an actor, to be exposed to ballet, to go to Broadway, but our children who are all over this city deserve the same type of access. Kalima, what would you say about that?
I don't know. I think we need to also expand our ideas of what art is.
Mm.
We
well
do art everywhere and in everything.
Yeah.
Art is consummate performance. We perform ourselves when we walk out the door. Mm. We perform when we're in front of people, depending on what audience we're in front of. Mm. Like, that, we need to appreciate that everyone has art inside of them, how they're representing, how they use it. And we also need to see art as a structural intervention. It's not something mm-hmm. that you tack on the end of
right.
an issue.
Right.
We use
exactly.
art as ritualistic spaces for people to come together mm-hmm. and work.
Mm-hmm.
on a structural approach, going up river to fix what's been broken, as opposed to using it as a tack on at the end.
Girl, I feel a song coming. That's right.
It does sound like a song. Yes. We had a tweet. Matthew tweeted in, and we'll pick up on this because it follows what you said. Matthew just tweeted in at Mark Steiner. He said, to challenge, confront, and bear witness to what is while presenting visions of what might be, what might yet be.
All right. Mm.
And I think that that is part of the role of the artist. And I was thinking about what both of you were just saying, and in other words, you were talking about what happened in that mural.
Mm.
And supposing, what would it be like if artists actually were part of the design and taking over of neighborhoods with people to build space that made sense for the entire community? What would that look like to you?
Well, I see artists as beings that can see around corners, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think often artists have the ability to think a bit outside of the box because they're trained to think outside of the box. So neighborhoods could look different, you know? People could have a different investment in their neighborhoods if we sort of respected the space and also acknowledge that everyone, even if they can't put pen to paper, as an artist as well. So even that woman who makes a community pantry where they make food together in that community, that's art.
Mm.
That's performance. That's space, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So if we start thinking larger and broadly about how we think about what art is, mm-hmm. and then we think about, yes, everyone has this in their community, then we can start thinking about these ritual practices that use art to sort of infuse and change them.
Absolutely.
Jump in, guys.
I think also artists have the ability to recognize the beauty that is art that's already existing in a community, mm-hmm. you know, and then well, the ability to yes. you know bring that to the forefront instead of just ripping down a community and building a new one on top of it. You know, let's go ahead and acknowledge
or gentrifying
what's there,
it.
Or gentrifying it.
Yes,
yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. I would actually like to ask David about the urban arts program.
Yeah.
I mean, because I think this is a significant and new. We're both involved with GBCA.
Right. Yeah,
and
yeah.
our lives are just.
Yes, they are.
But I don't have a two-week-old baby.
Yeah,
that's okay.
Yeah, yeah.
That's all right. All right. But seriously, about yeah. the urban arts project. Yeah. Now, tell us a little yeah. bit about this and, mm-hmm. and what are the what is you know the overall goal?
The overall
and
goal.
The end game.
Right. So the Urban Arts Leadership Program is one of two professional development opportunities through the Greater Baltimore Cultural Alliance. And it's brand new. It's in its incubator phase. And the idea is that we're going to strengthen leadership of color throughout the city. So equip them with professional development opportunities, that is resources that have been beyond them, networking or networks rather that have not been at their fingertips, and mm-hmm. Also soft skill development, which has through several conversations been a real issue when it comes to developing leaders of color.
What you're about to say, then we're going to hit the phones here.
Mm-hmm.
And folks, you can join us here at 410-319-8888. We'll come to your call in a second, Lolita. What were you about to say, Nether?
I was just going to say that just one issue that I think the Baltimore art scene needs to make progress in, and can, and it's just a matter of time, is that there's a lot of interest in arts from people that aren't in the neighborhoods. And the question is always about how to bring it to those neighborhoods in the right way.
Mm-hmm.
And more so not – it's more so after the fact. So if you're doing a play or I'm doing a mural or something like that, it's really nice when you get them involved in that mural or that play. But you only really have success is if they do a play or a mural after that, you know, or if they have, like, the interest and it's continued.
Right.
And the nice thing about stuff like that is, like, people, they see a man like you or somebody like me, and it's just, like, it's out of respect, and they see that there's a future there.
Absolutely.
And that they can, you know, do this. This is how they can express themselves. And it's really powerful, and people remember that. And I know I can only really speak through the street art scene, but they're really, and I'm trying, and many other artists are, through other projects to actually, you know, get these kids involved and try to find the ones that are actually serious about it.
Yeah.
And because you need that underground you know, channel of thought going through these neighborhoods. And also, you need the kids to think it's cool.
Yeah.
That's so huge. Right. I mean, I know when I was, like, mm-hmm. like 14, you know, I wouldn't be into it if it wasn't cool, you know.
Like,
yeah.
So, I can't tell you what a good point yeah. is. With the Baltimore Voices we work with, the teen middle school, when they started thinking singing spirituals was cool,
yeah.
I thought, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I got
good job,
it. Let's go to the phones.
410-319-8888, your thoughts about artists and their role in changing our communities. And Lolita, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great conversation. I'm really enjoying it.
Thank you.
I have one question, and I think you guys have already started to touch on it. I was thinking about, like, I've been in, you know, when you do, oh God, I'm getting my thoughts together. Like when when there's like this political event going on in the city, they'll do teach-ins. And I remember once that they did like a whole acting skit around the whole teaching, addressing the specific issues. And just like we have like small flash dances where people will come together and converge, like seemingly out of nowhere and just start dancing all the same dance. Do y'all guys also do that with doing plays? Do y'all, like, go into a community where you know there's a bunch of people at and just start, like, acting, doing something that's, like, relevant to what people are experiencing? There used to be a guy in Baltimore. He would come up with 30-30 Green Mount, and he was a Michael Jackson impersonator.
Yes, I know what you're talking about.
And he just drew crowds from all over to watch him perform, and they gave out complimentary CDs.
Yeah, he's still out there.
Really?
Do y'all do that with acting? Do y'all do that with plays? or, you know, with dancing or poetry. Yeah. It's a way to draw the community in. And then I guess the other important piece is funneling that energy someplace, you know, giving them a place, a space to have that voice also and so forth.
Yeah. Folks want to respond?
Yeah, that absolutely is happening. It's happening year-round. Different theater groups throughout town try and make that effort. Off the top of my head, I think of Baltimore Performance Kitchen, Single Carrot Theater, Glass Mine Theater. They all make an effort to connect with the community, investigate first. It's always the investigation about what's going on in the community, what are the hot topics. And then it's about, well, let's form this collaborative process that tells a story, and at the end of that story, after figuring out what that story is, rather, let's try and put it on its feet for presentation. And, you know, that kind of buy-in from the community always is a good thing and is easily replicated. You know, it's how they oftentimes these smaller groups build their audiences.
Well said.
Yeah.
I have a quick question. I think that what I would love to know what you guys think, because we have the emergence of the Station North and, you know, the other arts communities are surrounding as well. And we still have a slight schism between communities of color and the white communities, arts communities, and a level of trust that exists there. And until we get some type of understanding and the process of making that happen, we're still going to stay in the same place. What do you guys see happening that to make that different, or to make artists of color feel welcomed in these new areas, artistic areas?
I think allowing, making access very easy, like showing people how they can gain entry into the space. I think often it's the nature of our little dirty town that we all love called Baltimore.
Our little dirty town.
You know we dirty.
Because it is a town.
You know we dirty. We a town. We call ourselves a city, but we're totally a town, right? Yeah.
We're two people removed from everybody.
Exactly.
Yeah. Town mentality.
There you go.
For real, right?
Yeah.
So I think it's about access. I think so many decisions are made in a way that's about who you know and passing on information and these siloed spaces.
You're exactly
and
right.
And I think one of the major barriers is that people don't know how to apply to these things. How do you actually get a space in one of these arts districts? Where did that happen? How'd you get enough funding to say, okay, this is my sub-basement studio where I'm doing this thing? Like,
We love you, Jeffrey.
Jeffrey, that's right.
I was not dissing. Yes. I love you, yo. Thank you for that beautiful hug you gave me a couple months ago when I was walking down the street really sad.
He's so awesome.
Anyway, but lots of times artists of color or marginalized artists don't necessarily know how to gain access to these spaces.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And the process of how these decisions
welcomed
are made.
To gain access into these space, or not melt to feel welcome. Is your urban arts project is addressing that?
We recognize that there has to be a significant amount of outreach. And I think that's the challenge in this scenario that we're talking about now, is that the outreach isn't there. We have overlapping networks that keep reaching out to the same people over and over and over again. And really, there needs to be a concentrated effort on the part of all these service organizations and or just organizations to do a better job at reaching the city, those neighborhoods, rather, that aren't connected, you know. And that might mean that you have to walk into a neighborhood.
Exactly.
You know, not email a neighborhood, but walk into a neighborhood, into a community center, and have a conversation.
That's right. You know? You should be doing that anyway.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that one thing is that, you know, I mean, well, there's like this distance and the separation between the artists and the actual community members in so many situations in Baltimore. But at least personally, like I don't know too much about organizing, but what I always do is I always try to find that point person as soon as I get there. Try to – that in, you know. Because, I mean, I'll admit, like most of the neighborhoods I go into are dilapidated, mainly African-American neighborhoods, and I'm a pretty well off in the grand scheme of things, white boy. Like, that's the situation. Like, there's something weird there for sure. And something beautiful that can happen. But
there's
I mean,
also an access there too, of privilege.
Yeah, no, and you I'm privileged enough to be able to drive into this neighborhood for one and like afford paint. But the thing is, like, what you do is what's really important is to develop relationships with people in these neighborhoods. Yeah. And I have countless relationships with countless people. So when I go back, it's as simple as a phone call, like, hey, I'm going to stop by. I'm going to, like, knock on your door or something like that. And then that person, they talk to the people in the neighborhood. Because I can talk to the people in the neighborhood, and they might like what I have to say, but they're not going to vouch for me until this other person talks to them. You know, like, so it's kind of going through a trail like that.
There are a lot of people calling in. Let's try to get a couple of calls before we end the hour here. And Hesemach, you're on the air.
Hey, thank you for taking the air.
Hi, how are you?
And I heard earlier you were talking about looking at art in a different way. And one of the experiences that I had was that I have a number of horses that we use horses to for a number of different things, recreation, therapy, et cetera. But also, horseback riding and the things that individuals do with horses is a performing art. It's not a science. And at Artscape, I had to convince the promoters of Artscape that having horses at Artscape for children to ride was an art form, you know. And I think that when we start to look at the out-of-the-box kind of thinking that and getting more artists involved, that it is an area worthy of consideration, that individuals who perform with animals are also performers as well, and that it is an art.
That's right. I agree.
I think that's really a powerful point. Also, Hesemach, hold on. I want to get your number before you hang up. Producer will pick up. I want to talk to him about your horses. Let's get a couple quick calls and we can come back and conclude together. Brenda, you're on the air.
Hi, Brenda.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Really nice interesting conversations. And it's just so opportune because I happened to go down there in North Lodge to, I went to Red Elms actually. Looking for the guy you said Mark Steiner would be there with his book, Ivory and Ebony, only to find out it was last month and it was a rerun. In any case, no problem.
We didn't take that out of our thing. I'm terribly sorry that wasn't dropped out of our rebroadcast.
That's okay. I walked down the street to the Caribbean. I think it was Fiesta's, the Caribbean Village over there, food. The week before, I had been to across the street to a little coffee shop near the Strand over there. And you're talking about the access and the comfort level. Until you change people's attitudes, then it's uncomfortable. When I went to the coffee shop the week before, most of the white folks there looked at me like, is she real? Does she real? Why are you here? And I imagine they're in the area of colored people, so-called colored people. And they're looking at me like, you know, they're just looking at you. Like, you know, strange. Like, they don't look at the people that's the Caucasian coming in. So it's attitudes. You can change the laws. You can do everything. When you have people even coming in with those attitudes, that was what dumps the comfort level.
I think that's a huge point.
Yeah.
The woman told me that the neighborhood would probably look better, but her business is suffering, and she's been there 15 years. She said the people come in, and the Caucasian people come in with the art. They support the other Caucasians that day, but they neglect their businesses, the business that already exists, which literally is going to put them out of business in a while. So I just want to throw that out there. It's people's attitudes. Mm-hmm. You cannot change that.
Brenda, this is one last caller in here. We don't so we kind of think about what everybody's saying here. These are important calls. Maura, you're on the air.
Hi, Maura.
Yes, hello.
Hello, Maura.
Yes, I have a question regarding the guy that just spoke representing the artist community from the non-African American spectrum. I fully understand what you're saying. One of the things I noticed as being a performing artist and composer here in the Baltimore City, in the native of Baltimore City, that there's a disjunctive discourse between the community and non-African-American artists, and what I've seen is that there's a shelter where a lot of outsiders or people are moving in into the city and not allowing themselves or want to interact with the natives or local artists, artists that are here in the city. And
so,
my question would be to him would be, aside of himself, how many artists make a daily attempt to try to reach out to the local artists who are establishing the city of the African-American descent and allow them to come in?
We'll
try to exchange.
Okay, we only have a few minutes left. That's why you hear me jumping in. I apologize for that.
No
but
problem.
Did you want to respond?
I mean, to answer your question, I mean, I think there's a lot of people who are attempting. I can only speak for my friends and artists like I've worked with, and like we make that attempt, and we really do. But that being said, like I'm not proud of the general climate here in terms of that, you know, and a lot of progress needs to be made, particularly for instance, one thing I think is another step, you know, for instance, I mean, I can only speak to street art since that's my life. But there's a lot of old school Baltimore murals and muralists that have Shaw, there's so many that have
yes.
done so much amazing work.
Absolutely.
And I think that is the next maybe that should have been the first step, honestly. I'm not responsible for street art in Baltimore or murals or public art or any type of art, but I think that's an effort. And really quick, I'm going to respond to one.
We only have a couple minutes here, so go ahead. Finish what you're saying. But
I was just going to – the caller that was saying that they feel like an alien whenever they walk into something in this neighborhood. I think that one thing that's really important is for instance, I live in the West Green Mountain area. There is, a lot of kids there who, are not from the city, generally speaking, white college kids coming in there. Mm-hmm. And I think what's most important is they have to realize that this is a historically a black community.
That's right.
And they are in this black community.
And respected that way.
And they came second. Mm-hmm. It's not who came first, the chicken or the egg. They came first. They didn't come first,
The privilege is a powerful thing.
And they just have to keep that conscious of that. That's in everything
power.
They do,
Right.
That's the important part.
Then you have to tell it.
Fanon just tweeted in as we close out.
Fanon.
Said, no
Hello,
art.
Fanon.
What's up, brother?
He
That's
tweeted,
right.
No art, no freedom. Amazing panel, amazing show. Fanon
tweets
in.
Fanon is one of the amazing artists around here.
That's and people, right. This is something we need to come back to very soon. I think that we had a panel on here just the other week between white and black activists who never met each other before.
Mm-hmm.
Beginning to connect because the connections were never there. Because people don't know each other in this town at all.
Yeah.
One of the things that came out of that panel was, and some of the white activists were shocked, when one of the black activists said, when I was a kid, you have to remember there are neighborhoods that black people were afraid to go to.
That's right.
That's right.
In this town.
Handed
That's right.
Back in the day.
Highland Town.
Maybe 5 years ago it stopped. I don't know if it.
It hasn't been that long.
And there are even moments
still
now.
There, I don't feel comfortable walking into.
Me too.
As a black woman.
You tell the truth.
And when we were at Red M, as my producer just reminded me the other day, and we have to wrap up here, just a very closing thought was we were there and I know the things I noticed. I love Red Enemas. I love the people there. I love their social activism, reaching out across class and color lines, trying to create a revolutionary feeling in this town. I love what they're doing. But then inside Red Emma's, it was almost all white people having coffee.
That's right.
Outside
Red
Emma's were all these poor black people who live in that purple building, that blue building behind, some of the people who are putting station cars together, some of the people want to get rid of that building so we don't have those people in that community.
That's
But that has been the bus stop that you stand on to catch the 13 forever.
That's right. For the last 40 years.
1,500
years.
So we do have to wrap up. Leah, I love you.
I love you too.
Good to have
you. We have to do more of this. We have to talk about it.
Leah Gilmore here, co-hosting once a month. I love when she's here. And it's always good to have our guests here in the studio with us. Nether, Kalima Young, David Mitchell. Thank the three of you so much.
Thank you much. Thank you, Leah.
Thank you, sweetheart.
Thank you, Leah.
Peace, Baltimore.
Art is for the people. Power to art for the people.
That's right.
Mark Steiner Show is the center. It's a project. It's a production of the Center for Emerging Media. My God.
What is it, Mark?
Who knew? I don't know. Our producers are Mark Henry and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineers are Andre Melton. Our interns, Alex Boston and Matt Malice. Our theme music by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. You can podcast this discussion, find out about all of our guests, the work they do, by going to steinershow.org. You can also download all of our podcasts now on iTunes and Leah, March the 7th. Information quick.
Concert, March the 7th in Baltimore, www.commonground.org.
That's it. And we'll have that on our website as well.
Have it on the website.
And Frankie Lyman going out a little bit of him and for Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community.
There you go.
I'm Mark Steiner.
And I'm Leah Gilmore.
Take care.
Bye-bye.